It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, a beautiful summer Wednesday afternoon in the Allstate Showcase Studio along Michigan Avenue. Terry Savage is in the studio. We will talk to Terry about what's going on around the world, really, with oil, retail, all that coming up. A little bit later in the program, Tim McHenry, who is the brains behind, the CEO behind Cooper's Hawk. Have you been to a Cooper's Hawk? More importantly, are you a wine member at Cooper's Hawk? He came up with this series of ideas, really. One of the biggest wineries outside of California is right here in Countryside. So we'll talk to Tim as they get set to open up a new store in Oak Park. I think another one coming in Reston, Virginia, later this summer as well. And then a little bit later, we'll check in with Axios and the futures editor there, Steve Levine. He's writing about what's going on with Volvo and Tesla, among other things. But right now, say hello to Terry Savage. Welcome back. Did you have
good
a good fourth?
Oh, yeah, wonderful fourth.
Good.
Lots of cooking on the grill.
Did you? Nice. Yep, that's nice. Yep. I didn't know you were a griller.
By default.
No one else.
If I want it done right, I have learned to stop giving instructions and just
Terry.
Say, you know what, I'll do it.
Okay, let's go to oil, right? This is usually when people are driving around. The big news when it comes to oil prices today, I think they're down like 3%.
Oil prices are down on the idea that there's going to be a glut coming out of OPEC. Their meeting today on other issues. But everybody seems determined to pump oil. That the old discipline, remember, Sheikh Yamani would come out and the world would stand there waiting and Americans would wait in gas lines. That's over. And because we don't have inflation and oil prices are weak, you know, we're down around $45 a barrel, which is pretty low for all those people that thought we were going to run out of oil and
right.
It was going to be $200 a barrel. That hasn't happened. The other part of it is the U.S. is pretty energy independent. Oil is a global commodity and it trades on a global basis. But even if prices go up, we don't have that vulnerability to what's going on in the Middle East. So gasoline prices, I was just checking. I filled up yesterday, and I was surprised. You know, always they use the 4th of July as an excuse to raise gas prices. This is my summer rant. But gasoline prices were down yesterday, and today the
Were you a little disappointed? I mean, you got cheated out of that anger? You went to the gas pump?
Oh. I was thrilled. I knew I was going to say something today. But I just looked. Gasoline prices, national average, is $2.33 a gallon for regular. And a year ago, it was $2.22, actually lower. And then we had a big run up in the summer. There's always an excuse. A refinery's down for cleaning or maintenance or some outage, power outage, and there'll be an excuse.
But not yet. And now this news from Volvo today, I think, is pretty interesting, too, when it comes to long term. They announced that with their new models that they're introducing 2019 and beyond, they'll either be completely electric or hybrids.
This is so astounding. This trend could move more quickly than anyone expects to electric vehicles.
Right.
And that is part of the reason OPEC is pumping so furiously. Saudi Arabia has announced it wants to diversify out of its oil economy. They changed the next in-line ruler who believes in we've got to diversify our economy. They had their day. They had their heyday. And
do you think that's true? Do you think the heyday's over?
I think the Middle East is always going to be a trouble spot, and Saudi Arabia is always going to be one of the most powerful nations there. But I think the idea that they could hold it over, that number one, that oil prices would soar, that they could raise prices at will, and that they could have leverage over the U.S., I think that's history.
Yeah, you said something just a few minutes ago that the U.S. is pretty much energy independent. Who would have thought?
We are. We are. Very, very fascinating. We are not only energy independent, but we produce far more efficiently. We could drill one well that goes that not only goes down and taps into a pool of oil, but we have the ability now to drill sideways, so you don't have as many holes drilled in the land, but you can extract a lot more oil from the one hole you do drill. That's a big benefit to our energy consumption. Yeah.
Okay.
We're pretty independent.
All of that's going on while we expect to, read some Fed minutes coming up right after the show?
So this is today the du jour thing that the market is wondering about. Okay, we know what the Fed said last time. They said that they're going to raise rates again this year, and they'll let us know when. And they're not concerned about the economy. It's growing pretty strongly, despite no inflation. So their plan is to raise rates. Now we get to see, in the olden days, you never knew how the discussions went in the Fed. People agreed or everybody was on one side or the other. Today, they will release the most minutes of the most recent meeting, and we'll get a sense of whether the Fed was divided. There are a number of Fed governors that have hinted strongly, hey, there's no inflation. Growth is okay, but it's not booming. 1.4% in the first quarter, not much better in the second. Why would we raise rates now? That's the so we'll hear, we'll be able to see the debate.
And the answer from you has been in the past that the reason they want to raise rates now is just so they have that arrow back in the quiver.
Exactly.
Should they need it in the
bit
future?
Like a broken arrow. But again, I honestly believe that this could be what we're in now. And people are going, oh, my goodness, mortgage rates might go up to a little over 4% from a little under 4%. I remember mortgage rates at 10, 11, right. 12%. And honestly, if there were ever an opportunity to lock in a 30-year mortgage if you're young or to refinance and then lock in a 15-year or even a 10-year mortgage if you're going into retirement, just doing that over 30 years saves you two-thirds of what you'd put out in mortgage payments.
Things are looking up. Well, tell me what this means. What is a global synchronous recovery?
Yeah,
the
that's
whole
a new buzzword.
World is...
You remember, I mean, there's always a buzzword for every season. And the global synchronous recovery means that just like everybody was going downhill fast in 2008, now things seem to have bottomed out in Europe particularly, in Japan as well, and we'll leave South America out of it, but in the United States and even
South
in Canada.
South America's been saying that for a long time.
Well, South America's got its own set of corruption and problems, but for the rest of the developed world particularly, and that bleeds over into many less developed countries, the effects of the 2008 global financial crisis have worn off, and all the doomsaying about Europe. I mean, we haven't heard the word Greece mentioned in a while.
Right.
We haven't heard the word Spain mentioned in a while, or even Italy. And that's not that their problems are gone, but growth heals a lot of problems, and that's what we're getting around the world.
All right, so people watch the Consumer Confidence Report comes out, but there's a Michigan University of Michigan study that usually comes out a couple of days earlier, right?
Yeah, the Michigan's conference survey came out this morning, and it was up, but not quite as strongly as had been expected. And so there's some concern that maybe consumer confidence is waning a little bit, or the enthusiasm for Happy Days Are Here Again is out a bit. I like the conference board survey. We'll get that next week.
All right. So you're not too worried about what
we're still in very positive territory. I mean, we're back near the highs of 2000 before all this entire financial crisis happened. But you know what? I'm not sure how consumer confidence is being expressed these days, because we're not seeing it in auto sales and we're not seeing it in retail sales. We've had a number of bankruptcies.
True Religion. Yeah
True today. Religion, the jean store, went under today. And I'm wondering if the millennial generation is expressing, they're the ones with the money, you know, boomers. Leave that aside. They have a lot of money and they're taking it out of their 401ks, but they're really concerned and worried about making it last. So the shopping generation are millennials and Gen X. And I'm just doing some research on how they think about money. And what you're seeing, I think, is not the traditional status symbols of a home, a car or two or three, and a big car, not, you know, and this is my car kind of a thing. And you're not seeing it in clothing. So where's that money going? I suggest it's a lot of it's going down the drain after restaurants that are very pricey.
No, don't bring up the avocado toast things. That's that what you're going to talk about, the avocado toast?
Someone introduced me to avocado toast last winter, and I thought, what a great idea. I had no idea it was the trendiest thing in the world, but I really like it.
I'm fascinated by millennials and the idea that maybe they now, at least Glink will come in and say that they didn't buy homes earlier because
they didn't have the money.
And they were scared.
And they had student loans.
But I think there's a school of thought also says that they're just not as interested in that. That's just not
it's
what they're
the
interested
thing.
In.
Everybody out there who still has, as I do, I was looking in the basement, your mother's magnificent china, which you never used because you got your own magnificent china XD years ago when you got married. Turn and look at the next generation. They don't want your magnificent china. We have to start something where there's a great demand for all the stuff we've saved. Because forget buying it or selling it. Our kids don't even want it.
That's Terry Savage. We'll take a break, come back, and talk about gold, the value of gold, on the Wintrust Business Lunch. A little bit later in the program, we'll talk to Steve Levine, the editor, the futures editor at Axios. I don't know if you've checked out Axios or not, but it's one of my go-to sites now in the morning. Do you know much about Axios?
Yeah, well, I know the site. Yeah.
Yeah, and
I actually want to listen to that interview.
Yeah, and they do some great things. It's a lot of politics, but business and innovation as well. And Mike Allen and Jim Vandehyde are the two guys behind Politico. They came out and put this together, and it's a great digest.
Okay, what's your favorite website to read in the morning is?
Axios, I think, is the
spell
one.
Spell it,
AXIOS.com. And it means a value, it means something in Greek.
Okay,
there's a
relative. So here's what I read in the morning. This is totally unscheduled, but here's what I read. First of all, I get the Wall Street Journal delivered, and that's the first thing I skim. First to the left side and see if there's anything interesting I want. I subscribe, actually I get it free, and it's too expensive for you, to the Gartman letter. Dennis Gartman, who's always on CNBC, has become a good friend. So I read the Gartman letter, first of all. But there is something else, secret websites that you know that you want to read. Wall Street Journal, if you're a subscriber, has a free newsletter called The Daily Shot. If you're a Wall Street Journal online subscriber, you get this, an email online at about 2 in the morning or 3 in the morning. And it is around the world in charts. You don't really have to read very much. And it gives me the best rounded picture of what's going on. So that's how we start our mornings.
And that's how I read. I read Axios every day. So how's the Wall Street Journal doing? Do you have any idea?
Because the Wall Street Journal is the best newspaper in the country.
But I wonder subscription-wise and money-wise, because they're one of the few sites that don't, you know, I don't subscribe to the Wall Street Journal.
You can mostly get it for free.
It's hard to get Wall Street Journal stuff for free. That's what I mean. So a lot of the other ones you can find a way around it and do it. Wall Street Journal is pretty strict.
Oh, I guess I'm subscribed on all my, you know, iPhone and iPad. So, but I just, if you read the Wall Street Journal every day, forget, I'm not talking about is the stock market going up or the esoteric things about which hedge fund is in trouble. I'm talking about just good general stuff about what's going on in the world. I think, I know it sounds like a commercial for the Wall Street Journal, but the fact is, if you start your day that way, you're cool. You've got politics, you've got business, you've got
great features. You know, they did a great feature not too long ago that I can't, it slipped my mind now, but they do a lot of things that you might not expect from the Wall Street Journal.
And the best page of all, after you
now
read the
really
front left column,
yeah,
is to go to the editorial page and read the editorials and the op-eds, because it's not all conservatives. Well, the journal editorials are pretty conservative, but you'll get some incredible different views that make you think. And Peggy Noonan on Saturday on the weekend edition. All right, enough of that commercial for the Wall Street Journal.
Terry's segment now brought to you by the Wall Street Journal.
And, I don't know anyone there. I just, the guy that delivers it. Thank you for being there early.
You've been talking about gold for a few months now.
You know,
now you wrote a column
I've mentioned
about it.
Something interesting happened and that triggered that column. There's a new column up at terrysavage.com, and it basically starts with gold is so out of fashion, maybe it's time to take another look. If I told you that North Korea would develop an ICBM capable of landing a nuclear weapon, which we know they have, and at the very least the west coast of America, that Trump would be sitting down with Putin, and we don't know who's going to get the best of that one, but I want to see the handshake. If I told you that most of South America, Venezuela, was going under, that's a big oil country, and if I told you all these things were happening, not to mention our domestic political uncertainty, you would think gold would be like $10,000 an ounce, and it would have been maybe 25 years ago. As we talk, gold is trading at $1,221 an ounce. It hit a 3.5-month low overnight. It only rebounded about $2 or $3 on the news of this North Korean missile thing. So either gold is really an ancient barbaric relic, or I like to keep my eye on what's going on out there and the difference. This is not a buy signal for gold. It's a column on, first of all, let me give you a great website. If you want to know anything at all about the price of gold or what's going on in the world or what people think, there's a fabulous website called Kitco, K-I-T-C-O, kitco.com. When I get back, I'll post that on my homepage. I'll do that later today. Kitco.com. If you want the prices, if you want the long-term charts, gold is down from $1,900 an ounce in the summer of 2011. So we're definitely not in a bull market, but I talk about exchange traded funds, mutual funds, bullion coins.
It's more volatile. Gold is more volatile than it used to be.
Oh, gold is incredibly volatile, and it's no longer the safe place to hide, because when the market crashed in 2008, the price of gold, as I recall, was a little over $1,000 an ounce, maybe $1,100, and went down to around $800 in the midst of all that market decline.
Okay, you write something that struck me, that that maybe this new safe haven is the automated currency, something like Bitcoin.
I said that a lot of people think that gold itself would be displaced by Bitcoin. Let me say that Bitcoin is a commodity.
I'll explain, it go way back. Yeah, do very basic. What
I'm gonna
is
go
Bitcoin?
Back. Okay. I'm going to go back. There's a new kind of computer technology that allows you to create secure transactions. It's called the blockchain ledger. If you want to be cool, sometime when someone brings up Bitcoin, just say, oh, yeah, I'm very into blockchain ledger. You'll sound like you know everything in the world. And basically, that's the technology underlying various cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Ripple. What you do is you change your dollars or your yen or your Chinese renminbi to this internet kind of enabled currency. At some point, you can either pay with things for things with this currency, or you can convert back to your own currency or another currency through a not so complicated, but through exchanges that are not very well necessarily run technologically.
It's a little
I'm putting
sketchy
down Bitcoin.
Still, right?
Let me just say it's a little sketchy. It's real. It exists. And there's a journal article today how you could buy cars and everything else for Bitcoin. But the price of Bitcoin itself, like the price of gold, relative to the U.S. dollar in the last, maybe it's only 8 months, has gone from about $600 or $700 to over $3,000. I'm not sure what it's trading at today, but about $2,500 a Bitcoin for U.S. dollar. So it's a speculative market. I don't think in a real financial crisis that Bitcoin will ever replace a tangible asset as a resource for storing wealth, because it's a very thinly traded market and the exchanges have their own computer depth problems. But I'm not putting down Bitcoin. I think that blockchain ledger will absolutely change our banking system. Why should I go to Chase today and deposit a check and say $200 of it will be available to you right now if you want to withdraw it, but you have to wait a day or 2 days, whatever it said, for the balance of the check? Well, with blockchain ledger, transactions are made instantaneously, and they're already being made from banks. There was one in Canada with a bank in Germany. It's instantaneous. Immutable. It can't be changed once that ledger is created.
Terry Savage. You can read more at terrysavage.com. Thanks for coming by.
Fun.
Tim McHenry's in the studio. He opened his first Cooper's Hawk restaurant in Orland Park in 2005, and he's been sprinting ever since. Tim, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
All right, so next one is Oak Park.
Oak Park, number 29.
29, and 30 is in Virginia a little later this summer.
Correct.
All right, I want to talk about Oak Park, but the stat just came into my head. You started in Orland Park, right? First one. And the wine club comes out of Orland Park with their first restaurant.
Correct.
I read somewhere that there are as many wine club members now at Orland Park almost as there are citizens of Orland Park. How can that be?
Well, I think whoever came up with that concept is aggressive. But I love that idea.
but it is an idea that absolutely took fire.
Oh, for sure. I think what we talk about is that just the wine club alone from Orland Park is probably one of the largest wine clubs in the United States.
Tell me quickly what the wine club is and how it relates to the restaurant.
Yeah, so the wine club is a bottle of wine every month, special release, so only for wine club members, those specific wines. There's over 250,000 members in our wine club right now, which is just awesome. And it also includes a number of other benefits, including a lot of lifestyle opportunities and travel and such.
Are there wine club members who don't eat at the restaurants?
There are, but most of them are pretty involved.
Pretty loyal that way.
Yeah.
Do you pick up the wine at the restaurant?
Pick up the wine at the restaurants.
A moment of marketing genius.
Yeah, well, thank you. So even I get lucky sometimes.
No, I think you've done pretty well. With some pretty good ideas. The whole concept is described as a lifestyle brand.
Yeah.
Tell me what that means.
Well, I mean, obviously, it's a full-service restaurant, you know, scratch kitchen. We have our winery where we make wine. But now, as you know, we've been doing a lot of travel. We're really trying to take the experience of being a wine club member and creating benefits. We were down here with Tyler Florence a couple weeks ago.
Right, right.
So creating these opportunities where wine club members can share in these experiences that generally would be, you know, unattainable for most of us.
So Oak Park, have you had your eyes on Oak Park for a while? Or how
we
tell
did.
The story
we went, you know, we keep getting closer and closer to the city. So this would be the closest one of the city. And I always find it fascinating. You know, I was at dinner here a week ago and I asked our server if they'd ever heard of Cooper's Hawk. And it's like we were in Mars. You
is
know?
That
so
right?
The city's its own little bubble. So this will be interesting to see what it does.
Well, okay. Talk to me about that, though, because you do have to fit into your location, or you have to match your location in a way, or match the vibe. I was telling you, I had dinner with friends in Oak Park a couple weeks ago. There's a real different vibe there than there is, say, at the restaurant in Wheeling where I go to.
That's right, and you'll see it in Oak Park as well. So we continue to work with Aria Group Architects. They're awesome. We've worked with them since the beginning, and they are from Oak Park. So we did. This has a little bit more of a unique, little more pizzazz, maybe.
Right. Well, okay, so, but there's... I would imagine if you move into a location that has more of a restaurant culture, it might be a little harder, a little more of a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, I think we do well. You know, we compete in all the big markets. I mean, we're not, you know, in too big of urban. I think we would do great in the city of Chicago. People would always tell us, you know, like, oh, if you come downtown, you'll do twice as much business. I'm like, well, I don't know. We're pretty busy, but I know we're going to pay twice as much rent, pay twice as much in everything else. So we're really thoughtful in how we approach the
city. Is that what's keeping you out of the city, the costs?
No, we've actually, we've been at lease on three different locations, actually one across the street there.
Really?
And it's just for different technical reasons have not... So we need like 12 to 13,000 square feet. So it's just tough to find a location of that size in the right spot for
us. Is dealing with the city a different animal than dealing with the suburbs or other locations? I mean, you're in other cities.
Yeah, I think it would be kind of business as usual, but you know, all of our opportunities, we never got that far along the way. So,
All right, so you're in Oak Park, and I was reading about some coverage in Virginia about the Reston restaurant that's opening, something I hadn't quite thought of, and they talked about the different job fairs you're having there.
Correct.
Did you have job fairs in Oak Park as well?
Yeah, we did. We less of them because we had so much success right off the bat, which is always wonderful when you don't have to try so hard.
Well, that's what I want to ask you about. Tell me about staffing a brand new restaurant. How do you do that?
Yeah, so this is a 12,000 square foot, 300 seat restaurant. So we'll need, well, we have hired now 225 folks who are probably out there training as we speak. And, you know, we need experienced people as well because it's a complicated model, as you know.
Right.
So it's great. We have we're thrilled with the group that we have at the restaurant.
Has the job market changed? I would imagine it's a tighter market. Is it harder to find people, or are you finding different sorts of people?
I think it's harder. It's a little bit harder, you know, in the kitchen nowadays. But just because it is kind of competitive there. But you know, I think the benefit program and just our culture and how we treat and pay people, I think, you know, sets us up for success. But
right.
Yes, it's always the hardest thing we do.
I suppose in a way, if there are fewer jobs available, the people who are coming to you are coming because they want to work for you.
Correct.
Not because they're desperate for any kind of job. Does that
Absolutely.
Make any sense?
Yeah, no, it does. I think most of the folks we end up finding are people that are coming from current employment. You know, it's not that people are, you know, sitting
right.
on the couches looking for work. So,
all right. So you got the people, you got the jobs, and now I read that you're moving headquarters as well.
We are.
Started in Countryside right away, right?
Yeah. Well, we started in New Orleans.
Sure, I know
yeah,
at the restaurant. Yeah. But then, yeah. So when did you move into Countryside with the headquarters?
We moved in probably about 6 years ago. And even before that, we had a winery outside of the Orland Park restaurant in Orland Park. In
oh,
kind of an
okay.
industrial area.
Okay.
So
now you're moving the whole thing up to?
The whole thing up to 355 and 55. It's about 120,000 square feet. It's a massive project that is
I'm sure the mayor
exciting.
Woodridge is very happy.
They are. And they've been very good to us. Very
yeah.
good to us. Yeah. Great to work with.
That's nice. You reach a level now where you got a little muscle, too, when you're going in.
Well, we just say they were nice on their own.
Okay. 485,000 bottles of wine this year?
Correct.
And you're looking to double the production in just a couple of years?
Correct. Yeah, at the pace we're going.
Okay. So when I see that, I think there's got to be a story there. There must be something going on because that's fast. What is it that's fueling that?
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of things about it. There's no silver bullet with Cooper's Hawk. I think, you know, we do no advertising, right? I mean, we're blessed to come and spend some time with you here,
right.
which is great. But it's quality food, quality people, quality operations, picking good sites, and then just keeping the program approachable. You know, I mean, to be able to come to Cooper's Hawk and taste the wine before you buy it, I mean, I think that's just such a big difference.
It's great when you walk into a room and you're going to wait for a table and there's some guy offering you a glass of wine.
Correct.
That's a pretty nice feeling.
Yeah.
Okay, you are. You're great. You've got the great atmosphere. Great. There's a real definite sort of, you know, when you're at Cooper's Hawk, no matter where you are, you know you're there. But doubling production of wine, that's pretty ambitious.
It is, yeah. And it's really just a function of what the restaurants and tasting rooms need. I mean, so we don't sell our wine through any retail, I mean,
right.
just through Cooper's Hawk. So the growth of the company, along with the growth of the wine club membership, is, you know, necessitating us to
And
grow
you
that.
Can you can go into a restaurant and buy a bottle of wine.
Oh, absolutely.
You can sell it retail that way, yeah.
Correct, yeah, for sure.
All right, so let's go back to where we started a little bit with this lifestyle brand. Tell me the value of food and wine and sitting around a table, because I think so often we sort of lose that when we talk about businesses, restaurants, and all of that. There's just still great society that's available to us there.
That's right. And I think, you know, we really kind of encourage people. So you can't get on your phone and do that. You know, we're working on an app, but it, you know, Cooper's Talk isn't about that. It's about coming and enjoying people's company, enjoying each other's company, people with like interests, right? So if you're joining the wine club, you probably have an interest in wine, you have an interest in dining. So we kind of bring all these people together, and the friendships that have been created through Cooper's Talk, I think, is probably the most rewarding part of, you know, what I've experienced.
All right, Oak Park, I think July 17th, right?
That sounds pretty good.
What's the location again?
950 Lake Street, right downtown in the that ginormous residential building that's beautiful.
All right, Tim McHenry, good to see you.
Thanks for having us.
We'll talk again.
Thanks.
You know, we were talking earlier today about the fact that oil is down 3% in trading today, maybe not so much related to the news from Volvo or from Tesla, but maybe. Steve Levine is on a phone line. He is the futures editor at Axios. Steve, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Glad to be here, Steve.
Yeah,
thanks very much.
You know, we were talking earlier in the show about I've become a big Axios fan. I just think what you guys are doing is, it's like you wrote it for me, Steve. I don't know if you did. No one consulted me, but, you know, it's got the politics there, but there's also a lot about business or innovation. And I just think it's a pretty cool way to start the day. So I'm glad you could take some time to talk to me today.
Thanks so much for saying that, Steve.
Let's go to Sweden, or maybe we're going to China. I don't know, right? Volvo is now controlled by Chinese money, as I understand, but they made a pretty big announcement today. What was their announcement?
Volvo becomes the first major car maker to commit to going all electric. It announced today that by 2025, it will make no combustion cars at all. That is huge. Its CEO said starting in 2019, all of our new models will be either electric or hybrid, and declared the end of the combustion age for Volvo.
And so are they going to soon be followed by others, or do you think they're kind of going to be out there on their own for a while?
Well, it's the second car company. So Tesla, of course, is the first car maker to go all electric. But what it's saying, two things what it means. One is that Tesla this Friday will come out with its mainstream price electric car. The Model 3, the first one, will roll off the assembly line, and that's a huge event, too, 2 weeks early. And Elon Musk, until now, has held all the sizzle in the in the field. This is Volvo attempting to steal its thunder. But the other thing is that almost all of the German car makers have come in very, very big. That year 2025, that Volvo earmarked the milestone when it goes all electric. Almost all the car makers in Germany have established 2025 as the inflection point. All of them plan to be 25% of their vehicle sales electric. And all of this, just to put this in context, all of this diverges from the forecasts of the big oil companies.
Right. They're talking about single digits, right?
Single digits all the way to 2040. So there's a big difference of opinion here. This is the significance of Volvo's announcement today, and then the Friday when we get the Tesla Model 3, what comes next? Will consumers buy these cars in big numbers?
All right. So what's going to be attractive about the Model 3? You know, what I know, first of all, is going to be the price. It'll start at around $35,000, right? Am I correct in that?
Yes, that's right. It'll go more than 200 miles on a single charge. The Model 3, we don't even have any idea what it's going to look like yet. Yeah,
but he's going to make 100,000 of them this year, right?
Well, he promised 100,000.
Okay.
He's actually going to make. He over the weekend announced new guidance. It's going to be 30 of them this month, and he's going to scale up to 20,000 by the end of the year.
Okay.
But the thing is, when he announced, "I'm going to build this car," in March 2016, people lined up around the block, around the world. He got 370,000 people putting down $1,000 each for this car. He has the same cachet, that kind of buzz that Steve Jobs had. That's why the Model 3 is really important. It'll sort of signal to us, the sales will signal to us, is this a moment, a tech moment, like the introduction of the iPhone?
All right, I just got about 30 seconds left here, Steve, but we need to reach kind of a critical mass, right, for it to be, for cars, maybe a tipping point's a better word, with charging stations and all of that. Tesla, Volvo on their own aren't going to be able to do it. We're going to have others to buy in and really make the quote-unquote needle move, if you will, right?
Yes. So we are going to have the Germans come in as big as they've said, and Detroit is going to have to come in big. But really, all of that is supply driven. In the end, the signal will be from consumers. Are they going to buy these in as big of numbers as they do with combustion cars?
Steve Levine, the futures editor at Axios. Great to talk to you. Hope we can do it again.
Thank you, Steve.